This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. Many Canadians will do whatever they can to avoid traveling to the U.S. this summer. Halliburton's tourism manager confirms this summer's travel trend.
We're sort of hearing, you know, it's kind of like the pandemic all over again in some ways, where people are feeling like this need to stay close and this need to sort of like, you know what, maybe this is the year where I just go to a different province, or I just go, you know, 3 hours away and I just stay close to home where I feel a little bit more comfortable, and this is the year of exploring my own country.
Flash flooding is getting more frequent in Montreal and elsewhere across the country and the world. An expert shares possible solutions.
We need to actually deal with this CO2 that we have in the atmosphere for the next 100, 200 years.
An ancient fish helps scientists understand the evolution of jaws and teeth.
Next thing I know, I'm checking out one of these quarry walls, just looking on the side of quarry cliffs, and right there is a piece of placoderm just resting there, waiting to be discovered. Just waiting there, like, hey.
The Northern Pulp Mill in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, has closed its doors. It's now selling off its assets.
This has been a waiting game for landowners and people that supply low-grade wood fiber to the market. Quite frankly, the province and the government have been working very hard on this project, and I think we laid our cards on the table.
And a new residential complex in North Sydney provides welcome housing options for local seniors.
You can repurpose a building and give it new life.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome. Thanks for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassin, and I'll be with you for the next 30 minutes. Well, it's summertime. Many of you are taking some time off or will be soon. However, it seems that less and less Canadians will cross the border in search of a special or perfect vacation. Border crossings dropped by 33% in June. Canadian air travel also fell by 22% that month. Not a negligible statistic, as Canadians spent $20.5 billion last year south of the border. Elizabeth Oakley recently spoke with Angelica Ingram, manager of tourism with the County of Halliburton, who says she's hearing from lots of people that have crossed off the United States from their future list of travel destinations due to the insulting rhetoric by the American president. She feels that the boycott presents an opportunity for Canadians to take more staycations, explore their own country, and who knows, Halliburton in particular. Elizabeth Oakley met up with her.
I'm in the same boat. We did the same thing in May. We canceled a trip we had planned for the U.S. We canceled it before May, but same thing. We just felt uncomfortable. And I'm hearing a lot of that anecdotally from people, just not comfortable going down there right now. And I'm also seeing the data that you're seeing in New York. A lot of data, a lot of cross-border traffic is down.
According to Statistics Canada, the decline in car travel to the U.S. from Canada is now worse than early 2021, when COVID-19 restrictions were in place, with border crossings dropping 33.1% in June. Canadian air travel also fell by 22.1% in the same month. Last year, Canadians spent $20.5 billion south of the border, and the U.S. Travel Association has warned that even a 10% drop in Canadian tourism this year could cost the American economy $2.1 billion in spending and 140,000 jobs. Ingram says recession worries are causing Canadians to be more careful as well about where they're spending their tourist dollars. And while it's still too early to tell, that may mean more staycations within Canada.
I've sort of gauged a little bit of input and feedback from our own local operators and accommodators. They're cautiously optimistic that it's going to translate into more bookings for us and more day trippers. It's a little too early to tell. You know, they booked 6 months ago, a year ago, so that was probably pre the patterns changing. But we're also hearing that because there's some concern about the economy and possible recessions because of the tariffs, people are looking for more affordable trips. They're looking for staycations or day trips. They're looking for a cheaper alternative to maybe than what they usually do. So for some accommodators, that means that their bookings are down. But for others, it means they're also optimistic that they might get, you know, a family or a couple from an hour radius coming for one night. rather than somebody coming for a whole week, but it's, you know, it's still a booking. So we're really hoping in my department, we launched a marketing campaign in the spring to really tack on to this idea and messaging that, hey, we're close to home. We're kind of right in your backyard. We're a great weekend trip. We're a great, you know, day trip. We are truly trying to kind of make that work to our advantage this year, because we really do think we could be a good destination for people looking for an alternative. We've also heard that Quebecers are kind of a group that are looking for alternatives to the U.S. A lot of Quebecers do travel to the U.S. because of the proximity, and they are staying clear. They're not happy with the messaging coming from that country. So they're looking for alternatives. Ontario is kind of a nice next door neighbor option for them. So we've heard from our regional tourism organization that we could see an influx of Quebecers this summer and fall. They're coming up with creative ways to still attract people, offering packages and deals and incentives. And I know Sir Sam Zinn, I think, is throwing in, if you book a third night, you get like a $50 gas card to help with your fuel coverage, right? So I think they're being really creative, and we're definitely hoping that we do see an influx of bookings.
Ingram says local organizations are trying to host a variety of events and festivals that will attract tourists to the county.
I know this year, Hike Halliburton in the fall, we're trying to grow it and make it a bigger event. A lot of festivals and events that require people and volunteers, and that's always sometimes a struggle for these groups to find the people to man the festivals. But yes, I think that's one thing that we're trying to encourage, and I'm trying to encourage groups and places and say, hey, how can I help you? What can I do to, you know, help make this a success? I know Abbey Gardens is launching two new events this summer, a wellness fair and a food festival. And I've been working with Angela on those. And because I really like to see ideas like this, I like to see things that are different or things that have worked in other communities that I think we can translate to our community. And I try to work with a lot of partners on that. And I think shopping passports and incentives, you can win a prize and you can win a draw. I think those are really great. There's economic spinoff, and that's another nice sort of day trip kind of thing. So yeah, I think having more events is always a good idea. It's always nice to have something to promote and celebrate the area, and live music. That's another really good thing I think we see a lot of in this community. And we have lots of concerts, lots of events.
With lakes and forests offering all kinds of outdoor exploration and recreation, Ingram says Halliburton County has an inherent advantage in attracting tourists, but competition between regions in the province is very real.
I think a lot of tourist destinations are looking at the shift and saying, hey, how can we capture some of that market? I'm seeing a lot of that. I'm seeing a lot of local travel sort of campaigns emerge this year. Destination Ontario has launched a really great one. Seeing Ontario is supporting Ontario. And so everyone's trying to sort of get their piece of the pie, if you will. And, you know, we're fortunate in a way because we aren't super reliant on American visitors. We're not a border town or city. You know, certain areas are definitely a little nervous about the shift in travel patterns right now, because if you are dependent on American visitors, if you're Niagara Falls, you know, if you're Windsor, if you're these areas, you're not excited about the attitude shifting, because it's not going to work out for you. It's not just the American businesses suffering. There's Canadian ones suffering as well. So we're fortunate that way, because we aren't expecting a huge decrease because of the proximity we have. Landscape and geography is something that's very hard to compete with. You know, you can have great restaurants, great stores, but you can't make a great lake. So we're lucky that way, that we have the ingredients, if you will, for a great vacation. And you can't duplicate that in every case. We're sort of hearing, you know, it's kind of like the pandemic all over again in some ways, where people are feeling like this need to stay close and this need to sort of like, you know what, maybe this is the year where I just go to a different province, or I just go, you know, 3 hours away and I just stay close to home, where I feel a little bit more comfortable. And this is the year of exploring my own country.
That story was by Elizabeth Oakley in Halliburton, Ontario.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints,
local news nationwide.
Northern pulp will sell its assets, killing the idea of a new kraft pulp mill in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. The company owned by Domtar-controlled Paper Excellence has been under creditor protection since June 2020 after it closed its pulp mill in Abercrombie Point. Tory Rushton, Nova Scotia's natural resources minister, says the province did all it could to make the Liverpool mill a reality. The new facility, he added, would have provided a much-needed industrial customer for the low-grade wood fiber produced by private woodlot owners and mills like Harry Freeman & Son Limited in Greenfield. Northern Pulp announced in March that a nine-month feasibility study found that a new $2.5 billion mill in Liverpool couldn't turn a big enough profit without significant government support. Based in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, here's Rick Conrad.
Northern Pulp announced late Monday that it will sell its assets, killing the idea of a new kraft pulp mill in Liverpool. The company, owned by Domtar-controlled Paper Excellence, has been under creditor protection since June 2020 after it closed its pulp mill in Pictou County. Tory Rushton is Nova Scotia's natural resources minister. He told QCCR on Tuesday that the province did all it could to make the Liverpool mill a reality.
Yeah, no surprise, a little disappointed. This has been a waiting game for landowners and people that supply low-grade wood fiber to the market. Quite frankly, the province and the government have been working very hard on this project, and I think we laid our cards on the table.
Northern Pulp announced in March that a nine-month feasibility study found that a new $2.5 billion mill in Liverpool did not make business sense. It required an annual rate of return of at least 14%, and it said that wouldn't happen without a significant amount of government support. The province granted the company's request for more time to look for more funding for the project. Monday's announcement made it clear they were not successful. Rushton said the new facility would have provided a much-needed industrial customer for the low-grade wood fiber produced by private woodlot owners and mills like Harry Freeman & Son Limited in Greenfield.
For the whole area, the whole forestry sector in Nova Scotia, I'm certainly not taking my hands off the steering wheel here. We're going to carry on, and the conversation about a mill, I'm sure it will pop up again, and we'll be at the table to have those conversations. But right now, we're still investigating and working with the sector to achieve a market for the fiber.
Last May, the province announced a deal to settle the company's $450 million lawsuit after it was forced to close its Pictou County mill because of environmental concerns. Under that agreement, the company said it would look into opening a new bioproducts mill in Liverpool. In its news release Monday evening, Northern Pulp said the court-appointed monitor Ernst & Young would begin the sale process. Liverpool was a thriving mill town for more than 80 years. Bowater operated a pulp and paper mill in nearby Brooklyn from 1929 to 2012, which employed thousands of people in Queens County over its lifespan. But local reaction to a new mill was mixed, given Northern Pulp's environmental record. Ashley Christian is the president of the South Queens Chamber of Commerce. She said she believed a new mill in Queens County was a real possibility.
Well, the idea of the mill, of a modern bioproducts mill, was exciting. From an economic standpoint for Queens County, we did have some concerns and reservations about Northern Pulp's past, their reputation, and environmental record. I was expecting the mill to go through. Based on the conversations that I've also had with individuals in the forestry sector, it felt like they were pretty confident as well. So I was a bit surprised, but again, I think it was probably the right decision.
I'm Rick Conrad.
A fish that died 390 million years ago has a lot of stories to tell, and Dr. Melina Jobbins has her eyes wide open, observing some fragment and fossils discovered in the 90s. She made a major discovery in about 30 minutes of searching through Manitoba's geological history. She found a fossil of an extinct placoderm fish, which has now been described as a new genus, Elmosoteus lundarensis. This is a reminder that much of Manitoba's geological history was spent underwater. The province is the perfect place to find fossils of underwater creatures. More with Ryan Funk in Winnipeg.
About 390 million years ago, a fish died. But that isn't the end of its story. Fast forward to 2023. Dr. Melina Jobbins is observing some fragmented fossils from the 90s in the collections at the Manitoba Museum. However, at that time, there wasn't much material available on the newly described genus Elmocetus lundarensis to gain a good understanding of what it was like in life.
I went there to look at them, so back in 2023, and there were just a couple of drawers of them, so about three drawers with a couple of specimens in there. And it wasn't just Elmocetus, there were a bunch of other small specimens of fish. So there were maybe a handful of specimens of this animal, a handful of fossils of that fish. And I thought, okay, so either there's really not much of them, or it's just underexplored, which is, I suspected this was most likely.
Although it may not seem like it now, a significant portion of Manitoba's geological history was spent underwater. This has led to the province being a perfect place to find fossils of underwater creatures. So last year, Dr. Jobbins was granted access to the quarries in which these specimens were previously found, and luck was on her side. She made a major discovery in only about 30 minutes of searching.
So I went there last summer and then got to some of the quarries there, thanks to some people who granted access. And next thing I know, I'm checking out one of these quarry walls, just looking on the side of the these like quarry cliffs. And right there is a piece of placoderm just resting there, waiting to be discovered. Just waiting there like, hey.
Dr. Jobbins is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Manitoba, researching Manitoba during the Devonian period, particularly the time around 380 to 390 million years ago. The new genus, named Lundarensis, is based on the area in which it was found, at Lake Manitoba, near Lundar. The placoderm was originally under a different name and was first described by a University of Manitoba graduate student in 1996. This new discovery adds to the growing collection of material of these animals and our understanding of one of our oldest ancestors with jaws.
So we do know it was likely a predator as well, because we have the jaw preserved, so we can tell that already. So the jaws are made of two main teeth, so one at the very front and one on the side, kind of like halfway across the functional part. And the rest of it is a blade, so we know that it has a double function. So the teeth will kind of do the puncturing, and the middle one will do the pulling because of the orientation. It points to the back of it, which is very characteristic for pulling things.
These jaws are incredibly important, explains Dr. Jobbins, as more research into placoderms can help provide a greater understanding of our origins.
Hopefully this can help us with understanding a bit further what placoderms are being used for, which is understanding the origins of jaws and teeth. So I'm going to use this in further research to understand how jaws evolved and as well as teeth evolved in the first place. So how they first originated and again, the early steps to get to what we have today.
Dr. Jobbins will be getting her hands dirty again, heading out into the field to find some more specimens and other fauna from this period. She will also examine other formations, some older and some younger, to observe how species have evolved over the eons. As for the fish that was poking out of the side of the quarry, you can find it in the Geological Science Museum in the Wallace Building on the Fort Garry campus at the University of Manitoba. I'm Ryan Funk.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Well, you might not have heard about this if you're outside the province of Quebec, but the city of Montreal is still recovering from flash flooding that swept through parts of the island on July 14 and 15. Over 100,000 people lost power. Montreal, Laval, and nearby regions saw a month's worth of rain in hours. Cleanup continues in hard-hit areas like Saint-Laurent and Anticartierville. Four families are reported to be in the care of the Red Cross after their homes were destroyed. Ali Nazimi is a doctor of civil engineering. His research focuses on hydrology. Nazimi says that the heavy rainfall which caused the flooding is in part due to pollutants and carbon buildup in the atmosphere. Nazimi's research indicates that events like flash floods will become more common, more with Adaminis.
Ali Nazami is a doctor of civil engineering. His research focuses on hydrology, the study of waterways.
I'm saddened by this event, and my heart is goes with the people who actually got been affected. However, when you know the emotions goes back and you try to look at it from a logical perspective, it is no brainer that actually we have we're gonna have these events and gonna get more and more.
Nizami says that the heavy rainfall that caused the flooding is in part due to pollutants and carbon buildup in the atmosphere.
How we can face it, man, we cannot face this response in the urban settings. We need to be prepared for that. So mitigation is no working here. It's going to be very kind of like out of reach. Because even if now we stop greenhouse gas emissions, so if even today all the world decide that we actually stop the greenhouse gas emission, we need to actually deal with this CO2 that we have in the atmosphere for the next 180, 200 years, right? So it's going to be out there. So we're going to have this intense rainfall. We need to adapt with that.
Nizami says that more thorough floodplain mapping, more green spaces, and renewed underground infrastructure will be vital to protect against floods in coming years.
But what we can do in that small watershed, perhaps we can actually have some green areas. So part of the water can actually infiltrate. So if the part of the water infiltrates, you bring down the peak. Okay, so that's one of the things. The other thing is that we actually need to update our drainage system. Now we need to understand the reality is this. So maybe in some part of the watershed, we would be able to store the water for some time.
I'm Adam Innes.
Residential complex built in North Sydney now provides more housing options for local seniors. For Jim McKinnon, the move to the new Cora's Place seniors housing complex felt like winning the lottery. The 78-year-old says the move was long anticipated. Sydney Glacier Bay MP Mike Calloway, Northside Westmount MLA Fred Tilley, and Cape Breton Regional Municipality Mayor Cecil Clark celebrated the grand opening of Cora's Place with the staff, residents, and workers at the North Sydney Food Bank. In Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, here's Jacob Postlewaite.
For Jim McKinnon, the move to senior housing was long anticipated. The 78-year-old says the move to the new Cora's Place seniors housing complex felt like winning the lottery.
There's no stress. There's absolutely none. It's free and easy, warm, toasty. Can't ask for any better.
Jim and his wife Debbie were among 85 applicants looking to move into one of 19 units at the recently completed housing complex built inside a wing of the former Seton School in North Sydney, which is also connected to the North Sydney Food Bank. The housing development came as a result of partnership between all three levels of government, with $1.7 million coming from the Affordable Housing Fund, $1.6 million from Nova Scotia's Department of Growth and Development, $200,000 from Efficiency Nova Scotia, and $90,078 from the North Sydney Food Bank Society. Now that the housing development is complete, McKinnon and his wife have relocated from their home in nearby Frenchvale and says they're enjoying the sense of community in their new home.
We kind of gather out there underneath the tree. It's nice. Yeah, everybody, you get to know everybody. If you walk around, there's always someone to talk to.
His advice to other older individuals who might be nervous about entering senior housing is to learn to let go.
Oh, it's hard to leave everything. It is. It's because everything has a meaning, if you get my meaning. But the best thing to do, honestly, is take what you need only. Don't fill it full of clutter. You know, come with the idea of just what you need. Yeah, that's all you need is a toothbrush and change your clothes. And a new washer and dryer, which comes with the apartment. So it's not hard to keep clean.
The grand opening of Cora's Place was heralded by Sydney Glace Bay MP Mike Calloway, Northside Westmount MLA Fred Tilley, and Cape Breton Regional Municipality Mayor Cecil Clark, who celebrated Cora's Place with the staff and residents, as well as workers at the North Sydney Food Bank. The name Cora's Place is a tribute to the late Cora Shabib, a North Sydney Food Bank Society volunteer and wife of the Society's executive director, Lawrence Shabib, who also attended the event at Cora's Place. He says naming the housing complex after Cora is a wonderful, heartwarming gesture and talks about the situation seniors face as they move out of their homes and into housing.
Well, there's a real need in the community for more seniors housing, like, you know, newer apartments, and some of them are living in, you know, they're living in their family homes and they can't afford really to be there, so they're stuck. So you hear the stories from them here, you know, the ones that gave up their homes to come here. They're just so happy that they, you know, got to come here. So
he says they plan to build two more 10-unit buildings adjacent to the new housing complex. He also discussed how the food bank integrates with the new complex.
Well, some of the seniors, especially the ones on fixed incomes, come to us for food. So some of the clients that are here as tenants take advantage of the food bank. So, yeah, so on average a month we see about 100 family units, and that can be one person up to nine, I think, is the biggest family that we have. So, yeah, there's a real need.
He says so far feedback has been good, and residents are overjoyed to be there. CBRM Mayor Cecil Clark also shared his feelings about the complex.
To see the progress from transferring the school, former school facility, over for a dollar, and now see it to be a hub for the community, not only for affordable housing, but for the food bank, programming, hair salon, and more importantly, you know, the anchor for other developments in the region, and more importantly, caring for people and for community, taking care of community. It's a total community hub, and it's not about stigma. It's not just about need. It's about providing programming, whether that's people learning to cook in the professional kitchen that's here, people needing a hairstyle in the salon that's been set up, recreational activities in the former gymnasium, and for people that are here as residents to have a home environment that has vitality and life and energy around it every day, something different, new people to talk to. You're not just sitting alone or isolated, you're part of the community.
Clark was also asked if the model used to turn the Seton School into Cora's Place could be applied to other school buildings that are no longer in use.
So when you look at the former Seton Elementary School, this is proof positive that you can repurpose a building and give it new life and new purpose and meaning. And the meaning is in the hallways with the residents here today. This is just nice to see the smiles on faces, but people with a deck to sit out individually. It's not a complex that isolates people. We have another request to the province of Nova Scotia for the transfer of another school to try and have even more of this type of housing available and create more hubs for this type of affordable yet quality housing.
While the municipality works on those plans, Jim McKinnon is settling in for a long stay with no plans to go anywhere soon.
We couldn't believe that we did get the call because there was quite a few people down. We come down for like just to see the view, and there was a lot of people. Didn't really think we'd get a chance at it, but we did, and here we are, and we're not moving.
I'm Jacob Postlewaite.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists, Adam Innes, Ryan Funk, Rick Conrad, Jacob Postlewaite, and Elizabeth Oakley. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. Thanks to you and to this station for keeping us company and giving us a voice. And until next week, ciao.